You're listening to the Diplomats Asia Geopolitics Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Putz, coming to you from a rainy Washington, D.C.
And this is Ankit Panda, also in Washington, D.C. Good to be with you, Katie.
Good to be with you as always. So, in about 2 weeks, on April 11th, the leaders of the United States, Japan, and the Philippines will meet at the White House for the first trilateral U.S.-Japan-Philippines Leaders Summit. The trilateral is sandwiched between an official state visit by the Japanese Prime Minister, Kishida, on April 10th, and will be followed by a meeting between U.S. President Biden and Philippine President Marcos. In a statement about the upcoming trilateral, the White House press secretary highlighted deep historical ties, robust growing economic relations, and shared vision for a free and open Indo-Pacific, as well as noting a intention to reaffirm the, quote, ironclad alliances between the U.S. and the Philippines and the U.S. and Japan. Of course, the context for this visit is the endless churn of geopolitics in Asia, notably Chinese activity in the South China Sea. These trilaterals, and this comes in the wake of another novel trilateral last August's Camp David meeting between the leaders of the U.S., Japan, and South Korea. So obviously, this is something we should discuss on this podcast. Ankit, let's just start with the upcoming trilateral, and then we can kind of broaden into the wider context. What do you see as the main motivation for this meeting and for the timing? You know, why is this happening now as opposed to several years ago or another time?
Yeah, so I think that's actually a really good way to put this question, because reorienting myself with the broader trajectory of the Japan-Philippines relationship in particular, in sort of preparing for our discussion today, it was really interesting to sort of take myself back to 2016, when we certainly talked about Japan-Philippines on this podcast, I'm fairly sure. But, you know, we had obviously a five-year period in the Philippines where Rodrigo Duterte was president. We have to account for the fact that the Philippines had a very different geopolitical orientation. Not that the Philippines' interests fundamentally changed, but the leader of the Philippines fundamentally had a different view of approaching the United States primarily and approaching China. But if you go back and you look at what happened in 2015 and 2016 at the tail end of the Aquino years in the Philippines, you see the seeds of essentially what is now culminating in this trilateral summit, I would argue, right? I mean, that was a period when Japan under Shinzo Abe began reaching out to the Philippines, concluding a range of new defense agreements at the time, transferring defense equipment, encouraging capacity building in the Philippines on maritime domain awareness. Maritime domain awareness, of course, continues to be important given the many ongoing disputes and clashes, frankly, between China and the Philippines in the South China Sea, which we covered on this podcast just a few months ago. But again, as we record this in the month of March 2024, there's still been clashes at Second Thomas Shoal. You kind of see a straight line from the late Aquino years to then Marcos coming in. And you have this perfect constellation right now with Marcos, Biden, and Kishida. Three leaders who are very much in favor of greater networking around a free and open Indo-Pacific, deepening the two bilateral alliances here, right? I'm sure the Chinese critique of this summit will be that it's another effort by the United States to set up an Indo-Pacific NATO. But you look at the White House statement and you just look at the reality. I mean, these are two separate bilateral alliances that will be affirmed in a trilateral setting, but this isn't going to be the birth of some kind of trilateral security arrangement or collective security arrangement between the three countries. So I think that's the initial reaction I have. I think this will be all about Japan and the United States primarily, I think, demonstrating their support for the Philippines, which is, I mean, ultimately a less well-resourced country that is facing significant challenges to its claims of sovereignty and maritime entitlements that were, of course, adjudicated by the Permanent Court of Arbitration in 2016 in a binding ruling that China refused to participate in. So I think for Manila, it's going to be a really important moment to show that the Philippines is not alone, that it does have countries like Japan and the United States standing by it. And I do think we'll see the announcement probably of new measures from both Washington and Japan for the benefit of Manila.
Yeah, you know, I do think the sort of Duterte years were a little bit of a blip, but you're right that there were the seeds of this kind of engagement before the Duterte years, and clearly now Marcos is focusing on this kind of reaffirmation of that alliance with the United States in kind of context of the rest of the United States' alliances in the Asia region. You know, I am curious, you know, how you view this trilateral next to the US-Japan-South Korea trilateral, which is again another trilateral in which the United States is kind of we're gonna pull up the hub and spoke, you know, metaphor, but the United States is that hub and it has these different alliances throughout the region. And it sort of seems as an effort to kind of interlink them. I'm curious your take on that kind of view of these sort of mini lateral engagements and what that says about how the United States is sort of bolstering its alliance network in Asia.
Yeah, no, I mean, again, I mean, I think the buds of this all, you know, you could trace back to the second term of the Obama administration, right? When Ash Carter talks about a principled security network at the Shangri-La dialogue, he's essentially articulating what we now see being done by the Biden administration, which is pulling together, exactly, I mean, you know, breaking apart the hubs and spokes and trying to better integrate these alliances without getting to the point of an Indo-Pacific NATO, which again will be the Chinese criticism of this summit, and it was the Chinese criticism of the trilateral summit in many ways. I think the big difference is if you look at the level of depth and integration and sort of access, you know, the Philippines is a very different kind of treaty ally than either South Korea or Japan, both of which have a much mm-hmm. more integrated permanent U.S. military presence. You know, the other thing I should have mentioned in my initial answer, of course, I think the best articulation of how Marcos picks up the ball from Aquino on engaging the United States is the announcement last year by the U.S. and the Philippines of four additional bases under the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Act, which was agreed first in 2014, sort of foundered under Duterte when, frankly, people were concerned that the U.S.-Philippines alliance might actually end up getting run over when Duterte seemed to indicate that the visiting forces agreement could be abrogated. But that, again, I think speaks to the rapid acceleration in many ways of U.S.-Philippines cooperation. I think what's going to be an interesting, you know, something I'll be watching for is that I think there's a difference between Japan, the United States, and the Philippines on the Taiwan question specifically, right? And, you know, mm-hmm. let's be real, the whole value of EDCA, of this enhanced base access more generally, is to potentially give the United States more options and staging areas in the case of a serious Taiwan contingency. How committed will the Philippines be to becoming involved in such a contingency, recognizing that it fundamentally doesn't have the military capacity of a country like Japan? You know, the Philippines is modernizing. They are buying new anti-ship cruise missiles, so on and so forth. But that, I think, is going to be an interesting sort of place to read between the lines. Like, I don't think this summit's going to include a joint statement that says, you know, we're all in for Taiwan or anything like that. But I do think that will be somewhat present in the subtext of what the three leaders and their staff will be working on. So I'll be really interested to see how those issues are discussed. Conversely, we might not really see anything about that, and this might really just be the intended first step in a longer process of better trilateral coordination. Because again, I mean, Japan and the Philippines have been doing a lot independently as well, including their recent reciprocal access agreement, which does allow Tokyo to potentially play a more prominent role in that area as well.
Great. So you touched on this a little bit already, but let's discuss the Chinese view on this, because China has had a very strong stance that, you know, these trilaterals are the, you know, are actual efforts towards an Asian NATO, whatever that would mean for the region. Is there room for China to kind of not get its hackles up about this? I don't think the answer is yes, but I'm curious your sort of expanded thoughts on the Chinese reaction to these sort of alliance meshing efforts and whether the United States is sort of cared about that response while it's also trying to sort of smooth the relationship with Beijing.
Yeah, I think that final thing you said, I think, is really interesting, because the China-Philippines relationship is in the worst place of the three trilateral parties meeting right now. The U.S.-China relationship arguably has seen a big upswing. You just had that meeting with Xi Jinping and all the old men from the United States that he wanted to meet to talk about God knows what. But it's interesting, right? Because there is a universe in which China sees that it might have been a mistake in many ways to write off Marcos. I think Beijing had fundamentally made up its mind about Marcos not long after he was elected. And then this idea that he would be kind of pro-American drift towards the United States. And then you get into the clashes in the South China Sea. So one way to sort of play this differently would have been to actually not fire water cannons at Philippine vessels in the lead up to this trilateral summit, because this is exactly, I think, creating the domestic political conditions. You know, in the Philippine media, there's a lot of excitement about this summit, a lot of condemnation of China. So when this happens, I think this will end up, again, having the effect of just reinforcing China's belief that Beijing has had since Marcos came in about the broader trajectory of the Philippines and the United States. I don't know that there's really anything the Philippines could do short of capitulating to Beijing that would actually change that. I mean, there is fundamentally a international legal determination here, right? Again, that 2016 arbitral tribunal ruling under which the Philippines has attempted to exercise its rights to access the waters that the court determined were lawfully the Philippines under the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, and the United States and Japan again stand behind that. So that, you know, that seems like a place where China is very uncompromising at the moment, and so I don't see any way in which the summit outcome is likely to potentially cause a rethink in Beijing. In fact, I could see the summit outcome leading to continued and potentially additional forms of pressure against the Philippines by China.
All right. Well, I think we've sort of hit major topics here, but is there anything else you want to add before we wrap it up today, Ankit?
Yeah, I mean, the closing thought I have is, you know, it's interesting that there, you know, we're obviously in the final few months before a U.S. election that will result in a very different, I guess, prognosis for U.S. alliances in Asia. And so I wonder how much of the planning in Tokyo and Manila for this trilateral summit and the planned outcomes of this summit are sort of taking that into account, pricing in the possibility of a Donald Trump victory in November, or, you know, will there be a real effort here to institutionalize something that will be difficult to fundamentally wave away? Yeah. I don't know the answer to that, because I think a lot will come down to what actually ends up getting announced at the conclusion of the summit. But I do think that's interesting. I think I see a lot of that with many U.S. allies, not just in Asia, but even in Europe, about trying to seal in and institutionalize a lot of long-term symbolic objectives right now that could make things a little bit more difficult to be reversed under Trump. But of course, I do think, you know, both in Manila and Tokyo, there will be hopefully, or at least people will be mostly hoping for a Biden victory in November, just given the negative implications for U.S. alliances, I think, under Trump.
Yeah, certainly. Great closing point. Well, thank you very much to our listeners for tuning in. Please leave us reviews and share our podcast with your friends. If you have any suggestions for topics for us to hit in the future, Ankit and I are pretty easy to get in touch with, so please reach out. And before I sign off, I do want to put a little plug for the Diplomat's 113th magazine issue, which comes out at the end of this week. So by the time this podcast airs, it will be available. And listeners who are interested in this particular episode will find a very great piece in it by Richard Haydarian, focusing on a brief genealogy of Philippine claims in the South China Sea and some of the historical stepping stones in the U.S. alliance with the Philippines there. So I think that will wet your whistle. Is that a thing people say anymore? Anyway, I will sign off and have a great rest of your week, whatever point in the week you listen to this.